Hey listeners, if you've been listening to our show, chances are you've heard the wonderful contributions of our favorite Tolkien scholar, Marilyn R. Pukila. Marilyn just launched her own podcast on our network called Rings and Rituals.
Join me and Dr. Sarah Brown on our journey through the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power, through the lens of ritual. Episodes drop every other Wednesday on the Rings and Rituals feed, linked in the show notes. See you there.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Silmarillion Stories, where the Lorehounds, your guides to Tolkien's world of Middle-earth. I'm David.
I'm John, and this is our podcast on Of the Coming of Elves and the Captivity of Melkor, the fifth story in the Silmarillion.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the corruption of Melkor, the awakening of the elves, and the wars of the Valar.
Before we get started, here's a quick reminder that you can send feedback to lotr@thelorehounds.com. Or you can head to thelorehounds.com/contact and leave us a voicemail or a contact form entry. And we'll get to those questions on the next episode. Episodes will be released one per month towards the end of the month.
You know, we love to make podcasts for our listeners, and sometimes our listeners want to thank us for that. And so we have a way for that. That is called the Patreon. If you are interested in supporting what we're doing, head over to patreon.com/thelorehounds. And for as little as $3 a month, you can support us. You get ad-free episodes of all of our podcasts, early episodes when we get those out. Sometimes we throw in some occasional blooper reels, and we've got a whole bunch of other stuff planned. So if that sounds like something that you'd be interested in, head over, check it out. We would love to have your support. The community is growing, and it's really great.
Didn't we hit a milestone this week?
50 patrons.
Very exciting. Just
it is
a few months
exciting.
Ago, we were at zero. So I'm very happy that we have people supporting us and being a part of our community. So thank you.
Yeah.
Another quick ask. If you have a moment, please rate and review the podcast in Apple Podcasts, because it really helps us move up in those rankings and find more people to geek out about Tolkien about.
So March has been March Madness for us. We have been covering a ton of stuff. We will have just wrapped up The Last of Us on HBO. Mandalorian started, Ted Lasso. We've got Lorehound Plays, which is a new project where John and our buddy Brandon talk about video games. We had an episode of MC Universe just out with our friend Jean and I. We got a ton of stuff. So at the end of the podcast, we'll have programming notes. So stick around till then if you want to hear more about what we're doing and all the projects we've got going on.
All right, David. So back to the Tolkien universe. This is where we started, and this is where we're at. So you are the first time reader. We say this every time, but I'm going to say it again. What did you think of it?
This was another really interesting chapter for me. It was dense. In kind of a historical standpoint, like, you know, during the War of 1812, right? You know, you got that. Uh-huh. And then you've got the Begats in a way, because, you know, like you've got, they're making stars and they're waking up and the people are moving here and they're moving there. And then this group that got lost, we call them this. And then that group that went over there, we call them that. So it was really informationally dense, and I didn't have as much of the flowery language or beautiful descriptions of things like we had for the last time. Nonetheless, it was a very interesting and informative chapter. And then, like, there are certain things that struck me that I was like, oh, that's why in Lord of the Rings XYZ. or, oh, this river, or, you know, these mountains of, like, you know, I mean, I know the geography changed a lot as well over the times of the first, second, and into the third ages, but it still just gave me, when I first read The Lord of the Rings, I was really struck with that sense of deep history embedded in the world. And I had no idea about, I don't know, you know, maybe even Silmarillion stories hadn't even been released by then. I don't know.
Silmarillion was released, I think, I want to say 79.
Okay, so it must have been out by the time.
Hold on, hold on.
All right, don't get in trouble. Don't write in. Don't at us.
77, actually. All right.
Okay, so it was definitely out by the time that I first read Lord of the Rings. But I had no knowledge of it. There was no internet, right? There was no bullet board systems back then. So my recollection of reading Lord of the Rings for that first time was just like, whoa, there's so much embedded in this world. And then now, as a, you know, over 50 adult and coming into back to this world, coming back around to it, I'm like, wow, okay, here is the source for all of that feeling of how deep and big this world was.
Right.
And the Lord of the Rings story, which is just this one slice in this epic history that is connected to all of these other things, I suddenly could start to feel that connectivity across the ages. And so that was a very sort of cool takeaway I had after finishing this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, reading The Lord of the Rings after knowing the Silmarillion is just a completely different experience because you just see more color almost.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to reread the three books at some point after we get through with this.
Well, our new lore master, Lavinia, actually asked us if we would do The Lord of the Rings at some point. And I think, I mean, we haven't talked about this at all, but I think after we finish The Silmarillion, that's definitely something that I would consider.
Okay. That's a lot of content, though. We're a long way off from getting to around that.
I just mapped it out. We're going to finish January 2025 with The Silmarillion.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, gosh.
What a time.
Okay. Well, we just like Sam and Frodo, right? You know, you just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep moving towards your destination.
Very true.
John, what did you think of this, having read it, I don't know how many times before, and rereading it for this particular recording?
This is probably my fourth time, I think. I don't know. Because the thing is, it's hard to keep track of because I did so much like going back and reading. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would go back and read a passage for the Rings of Power and things like that. But also, this is probably my fourth like full time through.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I got the Tolkien Illustrated Silmarillion for Christmas from one of my family members. And I had not actually cracked it open until this one, where I finally remembered that I had it before I read the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And I open it up, and I'm very excited. I make a cup of coffee, and I'm sitting down. The kids are asleep. And I open it up, and there's no pictures in this chapter. So I went back to the Kindle version for this. But something that I did discover is that it comes with maps of Beleriand, like pull-out maps.
Oh,
and that's super helpful because that's something that I've always had trouble visualizing is the Beleriand, the area that doesn't exist anymore in the Lord of the Rings. I think that's really hard for me to contextualize. And so this has helped me tremendously. So I would recommend this for anybody. I think it's like $30. It's the Tolkien Illustrated Silmarillion, and it's actually, it has his drawings in it. J.R.R. Tolkien's drawings in it.
Okay.
And that's the unique part about it. It just came out last year.
Cool. That sounds great.
So anyway, aside from bindings, I had a good time with this again. Again, you said it right. This is a very textbooky chapter.
Yeah.
This is a chapter that's going to tell you the political factions that we're going to have to pay attention to as we go forward. Now, I don't want to scare anybody off. This is not going to be tested on. You know, this is this is something where this will map it out for you. This is sort of giving you the outline of who these people are. And you probably won't remember, and that's okay if it's your first time. And I will help you remember along the way. I will remind you who people are. And David, I saw you linked in the outline a flow chart. I had made a flow chart for the second age, but that's a nice flow chart for the first age elves.
Right. Yeah, because there was so much information about the elves, the different groupings and stuff, that it was really, I needed a visual aid to kind of help me. And I will say, too, about this chapter, for as text heavy as it was, and, you know, tracing the history of all of these comings and goings and whatnot, it actually still was a breezy read. Mm-hmm. Like I flowed through it. I didn't feel like I was weighed down by the information Tolkien was giving. It was a light step. Like I just kind of like, I went along and I was just like, okay. And the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And I never felt like I was inundated with too many facts and figures and, so dry pie, as some folks might say. It was still an enjoyable read for as calorically dense as it was.
And there are some good little meaningful nuggets, I will say. Even though it's a lot of facts, there's mm-hmm. a lot of cool little moral implications of things and
sure.
sort of implications about the nature of peoples that I think that are very easily overlooked, and things that sort of stuck out to me that didn't stick out to me the first three times. And I think that that's so fun about the Silmarillion, is that there's something new to get out of it every time you read it.
Right. Yeah, I've got a good dozen or so highlights in my Kindle version. And made some thoughts there were things that made me think and go, huh, interesting. Well, what about this? Or, you know, why that? It was engaging as well as informative.
Well, why don't we get into it, since this is such a long and dense chapter?
Sounds good.
So, let's start with the coming of elves.
Mm-hmm.
While Aman was filled with the light of the trees, Middle-earth lay in twilight. Orome and Yavanna are the only Valar who still go to Middle-earth. Yavanna grieves because the promise of spring was stayed. She put many of her creations to sleep to prevent their aging. So this is something, again, grief is leading to beauty, right? And this is something that we talked about with the creation of the trees, that Tolkien is very interested in linking grief to a future beauty, especially with all the tragedy he faced in his life.
Right. Yeah. And I think I have that noted somewhere else too, that there is this, like, see if I can find that particular, this is a little bit further into the chapter, but, and sorrow and wisdom have enriched it, which is a comment about the Quendi in their days of youth. And I thought it was really, where in Western North American literature and story do we ever talk about how sorrow and wisdom enrich beauty? Like, that is not I don't know that I've ever encountered that construction before in this way. And it really made me pause for a second. And as you said, yeah, we've talked a lot about how Tolkien has brought his whole being into his writing. And there's a lot of sorrow in his being, you know, from the passing of his parents, being an orphan, the struggles of, like, trying to be a young man, a Catholic man in a Protestant country, falling in love with an older woman, going to war, having most of your friends die horrifically in that war, and all of the other young men that you were around, and on and on. And it's all there in the writing.
Right.
And so that he is able to extract sorrow and wisdom to enrich the beauty, that's wow. I don't know. I don't have any words for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I always love when Tolkien brings that kind of thing into here, because this is just such an emotional truth of his life. And again, we talk about how Tolkien wants to bring truth out of myth, right? Myths are made to highlight and to recognize a truth of the human experience.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Something else I noticed in this passage, Yavanna has to, just like her husband with the dwarves, has to put her creations to sleep.
Right.
And to await the children of Iluvatar. So let's go to Middle-earth and figure out what's going on. Okay. Melkor was ruling in Middle-earth, and he was in his fortress at Autumno in the north. He gathered his forces and sent monsters out. Melkor also created a fortress and armory in the northwest called Angband, manned by our good friend Sauron.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting to know that Sauron is here and active in the world. I was like, oh, interesting.
Right, right, definitely. Sauron is a big bad from the beginning. He's second in command, but he's not far behind.
Right, and he has a different attitude than his boss does. and we've talked about this before, how his boss is sort of chaotic and destructive. Sauron wants to dominate and control, but he doesn't want to destroy.
Right. So here's a beautiful passage, I think, a beautiful, horrifying passage about the Balrogs that, that stuck out to me. And in Autumno, he gathered his demons about him, those spirits who first adhered to him in the days of his splendor, and became most like him in his corruption. Their hearts were afire, but they were cloaked in darkness, and terror went before them. They had whips of flame. Balrogs, they were named in Middle-earth in later days.
There you go. Yeah. And when we see them as mere mortals, you know, us as the viewers of the fellowship trying to cross that chasm in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. To see that Balrog so epically created, like, imagine a whole army of Balrogs. Terrifying.
Yeah. Even with the controversy about the wings.
Yeah, true. Right.
Mm. Yavanna, after seeing the destruction of Middle-earth, rallies the Valar to ready the world for the elves. Tolkis wants to go to war, but Manwë stops him from doing so.
Tolkis. We get Tolkis back.
Yeah, I love Tolkis. He's really like, ha-ha, we need to go to war right now.
Exactly. Let's go. It'd be fun to... I mean, I know we don't have a lot of stories about Valar. I don't know that you could make any stories about Valar, you know, additionally. But yeah, he is such a fun character. It would be fun to see. Or, you know, something inspired by his spirit. That would be a fun thing.
Yeah, definitely. I love how Yavanna goads Manwë, right? She goes... Shall they walk in darkness while we have light? Shall they call Melkor Lord while Manwë sits upon Tanaquetil?
Yeah, she goads him. Like, that's exactly the right phrase for it.
The case against Manwë gets stronger. He's like, they'll be fine. Ugh. One of the worst rulers of all time. Just kidding. He's not that bad. But he certainly has a lot to work on. And I think that that's pretty interesting that Tolkien makes his... King of the gods, King of the Valar, a flawed character who has issues with leadership.
Right. Well, and the Valar, you know, they're a mixed bag. They're not the, you know, they don't necessarily do a great job.
Yeah, they don't. Some of them do. And I mean, they are the ones who created the world. If Melkor hadn't tainted it, it actually would have been even better. But they do wait a long time to solve their problems, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
So Manwë insists Varda will be responsible for the elves' light, because that's just the plan, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Varda takes silver dews from Telperion, one of the two trees, and made the stars. As a result of these efforts, she is given the honorific by the elves of Elentari, which means Queen of the Stars.
There was it's interesting, I'm sure, I'm not sure I know that there are Tolkienists out there who actually study the star stuff when they were during Rings of Power, they were comparing the text and the stars and trying to figure some stuff out. So it's really, it was really interesting to read the creation of all these different constellations and stars.
I know.
In here. And I had to laugh at the end of this sort of recitation of all the stars. Tolkien cannot avoid this one thing, which we've always pointed our fingers on, and he writes here, and I don't know how to pronounce this one, Menelmakar, with his shining belt that forebodes the last battle that shall be the end at the end of days. And I was like, oh, come on, we've got to have another reference to the, you know, to the final days, you know, so the whole, you know, Catholic, you know. Thing about, you know, the end times and then the, you know, the reconstruction afterwards. I just had a chuckle at that little line.
For a guy who will not write the end time story, he sure does like to talk about it a lot.
A lot. It's constantly everywhere.
One other quick note is that, you know, we talk about the honorific Elentari that Varda was given, but Varda's given a bunch of names because the elves just love to rename people. And so if you remember in the Lord of the Rings, well, this is in the book. I don't think it's in the movie. But in the Lord of the Rings books, Frodo uses an honorific title, Elbereth Gilthoniel, to invoke Varda against the Nazgul, which makes them run away.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, her name being invoked is powerful enough to send away Nazgul.
So there was one line, John, that sort of jumped out at me towards the end of this, another line that jumped out at me at the end of this recitation, and when it tells of Varda ending her labors, and the blue fire of Helion flickered in the mists above the borders of the world. And for some reason, that blue fire of Helion just struck me as an interesting construction. I didn't know sort of what it means. So I did a quick Google search. And on the Tolkien Gateway, it says that this was the Middle Earth name for a star known that we know as Sirius, the Dog Star.
Hmm.
And it was part of, oh gosh, I'm going to butcher this, Tel-U-Metar, the name the elves gave to the constellation of Orion.
Interesting.
So, yeah. But I just love this linguistic construction. The blue fires of Helion flickered in the mists above the borders of the world. In that hour, the children of the earth awoke. It's like so evocative. Just it tonally, his words just resonate. And then I'm thinking like, oh, blue fire. What is Helion? Like it engages me constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, even just the silver dews of Telperion, right? That's what the stars are made out of, this dew.
Beautiful.
It almost feels like that she is using ink on the skies, which is just, yeah, it's beautiful imagery. Like you said earlier, this is a great literary passage, even though it's chock full of facts.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned that the elves awake. So when the making of the stars was complete, the elves awoke in Quivienen. Quivienen is the Eden of the elves. Remember, we talked about multiple Edens, iterations of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible for the elves to return there because of the changing of the world. So this is also something that we see that this is a dynamic world, right? The world keeps changing from chapter to chapter when we're early on. And then it'll keep changing through the ages, although it slows down. One other thing, the elves named themselves the Quendi, meaning those who speak with voices.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that by implication, the Vala, I forget the...
Valar plural. Is plural, Vala is singular.
Thank you. The Valar must have some sort of telepathic communication.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of surprised by the fact that the Quendi speak with voices. Even though there are sounds in the world, this idea of language and this awakening to language is a interesting thing because Tolkien loved language. So it's like it's embedded in the DNA of all of his writings, this thing about language and how language turns on a part of your being that it doesn't otherwise.
Yeah. Something that Marilyn wrote back to us after our last Silmarillion episode is this idea that I posited from last episode where the Valar could sort of see into each other's minds if they open up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This is called Osanwe Kenta.
Okay.
And it's exactly what I said. It's just, you know, you can open yourself up to another being who can then sort of see your intentions, see your vibe.
Right. Interesting.
And if you close yourself off, other people get suspicious of you.
Right. Right.
And that's sort of how the Valar seem to have been communicating. So you're right. It was very surprising for them to come across these people who are just speaking.
Right. Yeah. And making these utterances, even though there's sound in the world, because I think at some point Orome stops because his steed, you know, whinnies and neighs. So there's an auditory clue there, right? Oh, it's not like there's it's silence, but the fact that beings are speaking, that's something different.
Right, exactly. Speaking of Orome, he is the hunting Vala, and he happens upon the elves at Quivienen, hearing them singing. Orome loved the elves and named them the Eldar, the people of the stars.
Yeah, this was interesting. There's this quote here that jumped out at me. From without the world, though all things may be for thought in music or foreshown in vision from afar, to those who enter verily into Ea, each in its time, shall be met at unawares as something new and unforetold. I have no idea what to make of this passage, but it's beautiful.
Oh, yeah, no, see, this is what I got out of it. I think this is fascinating.
Okay.
Is that when they are without creation, so when they were making the music of the Ainur, sure, they knew the whole plan. But the minute they go into creation, into Ea, they have imperfect memories. They suddenly don't remember everything. So you remember when Yavanna in the last chapter went up to Manwë and said, hey, pretty sure the Ents were in the song. I sang it. He goes, let me think about it. Then he has to meditate. And then he goes, oh, I see it there.
Right.
And even then, they sort of get the vibe that the children are coming, but they don't know exactly when. And so the Valar are sort of nerfed the minute they go into Ea. They need to really, though, they need to recall things. They need to learn things for the first time. And I think that that's super interesting that Eru Iluvatar did that to them.
Right. It sort of creates this veil that they have to now. Yeah. You sort of transit this this threshold. And when you're there, you're changed. You can't see it all, because if you did know it all and see it all, that would be like having the power of Iluvatar in a way.
Right. And this is something that we talked about in the Second Age podcast of Iluvatar wanted his children, the elves and the men, to have their own identities. He didn't want the Valar to just go make them mini Valar. He wanted them to, you know, be the Quendi, be the people of language, and have their own culture and have their own values and be able to do things in Middle Earth. And I think that if he had given the Valar notice, hey, they're going to be in Quivienen at this time, and this is what needs to happen in that time, now you're messing with free will. And that's something that Iluvatar is very committed to.
Right, right. And if the Valar knew everything and were managing everything, then free will would not have the space to be exercised, I guess you could say.
Right. Right.
Interesting to note here, it says, in the beginning, the Eldar children of Iluvatar were stronger and greater than they have since become, but not more fair. So the elven, you know, beauty is still, they're still as fair and beautiful, but
we're
not
still hot. That's what the writers are saying. We're still hot.
But they're not as strong as they were when they first were created. So there's some diminution of their potency. I don't know how to describe it, but they're not as vital as they were when they started.
Well, if we take the Silmarillion at its word, if we take this as fact and not just elvish propaganda, which I think there's an argument that it is, there are definitely feats in the First Age that you would never think a second or third age elf would be able to do.
Okay.
So we'll get to it. I don't want to spoil it, but we definitely have some things where you go, an elf did that, not a Valar.
Okay. Got it. That's cool. That's interesting to know. Again, yeah. Again, informationally interesting. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Many of the Quendi feared Arame because of Melkor's monsters. They were hunted, so they feared a hunter. Melkor spread lies to cause fear of Arame, but when the Quendi saw Arame, they saw the light of Ammon in his face, and, quote, all the noblest of the elves were drawn towards it. That is elvish propaganda if I've ever seen it. We are descendants of the noblest of elves who went with Orome.
Right. Very funny. Yeah, and interesting that Iluvatar, again, you know, this whole sort of free will, and you got to let sort of things unfold, but the fact that the children are allowed to be hunted and harried and captured by Melkor and Melkor's forces, you know, it's Eden was very short-lived here in this regard.
Yeah, yeah, it was. Although we don't know really where the Avari went, so maybe there's some people still hanging around.
Right. But just the fact that, you know, that Melkor was allowed to capture and torture and, you know, corrupt them and you know, put fear into their hearts, all of these things is, you know. But that's also a truth in our world, right? And that's interesting. Here's an interesting thought, right? I mean, often people who have deeply held beliefs, especially around a monotheistic, you know, deity, will question, well, why does our God allow for things, horrible things to happen?
Right.
For children to die, for natural disasters to occur where many people are killed, you know, and how or why is that? And that's just a truth of our world, right? Like, regardless of your, however you answer that question in religion, in a way, that's kind of here in this world, right? It's like, well, yeah, Iluvatar is there and the Valar are there, but yet, you know, evil and terrible things still beset the people.
Shall they call Melkor Lord while Manwë sits upon Tenequetil? Yeah. That's really the answer. Seriously. We don't even need religion because it was just Manwë being lazy the whole time.
Yeah.
No, it's, you're right, though. This is something that people wrestle with, especially Tolkien as a Catholic. And mm-hmm. even his friend C.S. Lewis wrote a whole book about this, The Problem of Pain, where he tried to figure out, like, why would, in my religion, I have a loving God, why would this God allow this pain to happen? Exactly. And that's a hard question that no one has ever been able to solve.
Right. And we see some, I don't know, I kind of see some of that here in this story. You know, that the, for whatever reason, you know, bad things happen to good people. Like, the elves are innocent at this stage, right? And they're Iluvatar's firstborn. And yet he allows terrible things to befall them. I mean, the next section here, right, where they get taken and corrupted into orcs.
Right. Yeah, so we learn that those who were captured by Melkor were likely corrupted and turned into orcs. Melkor could not create life, but he could corrupt it. And there's a line that says, I don't have the exact wording, but this was the most hateful act to Iluvatar that Melkor ever did.
I have this here. This, it may be, was the vilest deed of Melkor, and the most hateful to Iluvatar. Yeah.
I will note here, too, and we've discussed this in the Second Age, that Tolkien wrestled with this. This was not necessarily his for sure the orcs came from elves theory, but it is the theory that Christopher selected for the Silmarillion, so that is the traditionally canon theory. Tolkien did have some issues with the idea that a being could corrupt you away from your free will and turn you to evil. Uh-huh. I think that was the issue with it. It was a tricky thing. And then the idea, the other question is, then can an orc be redeemed? Who knows?
Right. And I think they are, the showrunners for the Rings of Power have certainly opened this conversation with the character, remind me the name, it's been a minute since
Adar.
With Adar,
who was recast,
right? We know, right? Yeah, that's a production
crazy
thing. But with Adar, right, the, you know, and the, you know, they were calling him father, and now what they do in the show with the storyline and the character, who knows? But the idea that Adar could be one of these sort of corrupted elves is a fascinating element in the story overall, and then they're bringing it to us on the screen. So we have yet to see where they're going to go with that.
Right. And just the idea that the lies of Melkor were enough to stoke fear into the elves and keep a lot of them from the Valar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's beautiful passages here about beautiful in a sort of a terrible way, of how they were afraid of Orome because of the sort of the dark shadows that would fly across the sky and, you know, creatures in the forest. And so they see this guy on this, you know, on this steed, and they're like, whoa, he looks like all of this other scary stuff that we've seen.
Well, and the idea is, I said this in my summary, but they were hunted, so they feared a hunter, right? So
exactly.
So yeah, Melkor was just taking, he was hunting elves that were getting too far away from their communities.
Yeah.
And then basically Melkor creates this faceless, nameless villain, the hunter. And because of that, because they have not actually seen Orome, because they have not actually met Orome, he's so terrifying to them.
Right.
And then when they finally go face to face with him, and they meet him.
Light. Yeah.
They see the light. And I think that maybe Tolkien's trying to say, you know, sometimes we fear something just because it's foreign, right? It's mm-hmm. it's, and sometimes when we see that thing face to face, we realize it was not the villain after all.
Right, right. Interesting.
All right, well, why don't we take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll get into the captivity of Melkor. And we're back. David, are you ready to talk about the captivity of Melkor?
Yes, because I want to get someday to the unchaining of Melkor.
Mm.
But Maester first Anthony. We have to capture him. Yes, exactly. We're going to do that, I think, in June. Maester Anthony is going to be our guest for that chapter. He was pretty keen on that chapter, so that should be a fun conversation.
I've just booked another guest, too.
Oh, you did? Great.
I did. For September, we're going to have Tea with Tolkien on.
Oh, lovely.
Very exciting.
And we have talking about Tolkien, Mary Clay as well next month.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. That's right.
Yeah.
That's the show.
We got a lot of people coming on. We try to have some friends in the Tolkien community and share some voices. And I hope that people like it because I like these people. So Aramé returned to Valinor to tell the Valar about the elves. The Valar were happy to hear of the coming of the children of Ilúvatar, but now had the problem of them being stuck in Melkor's world. After meditation, Manwë determines that Eru's will is that the Valar should retake Middle-earth. The Valar go to war, defeat, and capture Melkor. I love the idea that Manwë is so hesitant to retake Middle-earth, and then finally, the elves are suffering enough, and he goes into meditation mode for 5 minutes and is like, yeah, all right, let's do it.
He sat long in thought upon Tana Gwetel and sought the counsel of Ilúvatar. Yeah.
Is this almost a Buddha thing?
It is very, very interesting, this whole meditative side of Manwë. Again, something that I don't recall seeing or encountering in other fantasy novels, where like the king of the gods here has to go into a meditative state to hear the instructions from the divine, you know, Lord, as it were. In this paragraph here where it says, you know, that where Manwë went to meditate, it ends with, and coming then down to Valmar, he summoned the Valar to the Ring of Doom. And thither came even Olmo from the Outer Sea. What is the Ring of Doom?
Oh, that's basically the Valar's court, right? This is this is where they hold court there, right? They're like, okay, what do we do here? Doom is in fate, right? We've talked about that before.
Okay.
It's not really like doom. It's like doom. What's going to happen?
Okay, I know that definition of doom, but then I just, you know, the construction of Ring of Doom, and then I'm thinking, like what is this Ring of Doom thing? Because obviously we have rings in another context. And I wasn't thinking of like an actual piece of jewelry as such, but like, you know, what is the Ring of Doom? Because don't they bring Melkor back to the Ring of Doom later? So
there's a whole thing. He's got to get chained up.
Right.
Never did Melkor forget that this war was made for the sake of the elves and that they were the cause of his downfall.
Mm.
And neither did Sauron.
Right.
Which is fascinating because they didn't even know what was going on, right? They didn't ask for the Valar to come.
Mm-hmm.
They were fine in Quivien, and I mean, they had their issues of getting, you know, kidnapped. But other than that, they were fine, and they didn't ask the Valar to come. And they came, and they solved the problem for them. But Melkor blames the elves. He thinks in his head, if the elves never came, I had a good thing going here in Middle-earth. I could have just stayed here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are Ilúvatar's children, so you're really messing with God's grand plan here. So, you're going to pay. You're going to pay there's a price to be paid here for your actions.
I mean, if Melkor hadn't been kidnapping them and turning them into orcs, the Valar might have left him alone, right? If he had been like, you know what, we had our fun destroying Middle-earth, but now the children are here. and I'm going to be a benevolent ruler of Middle Earth. I bet you Manway would have been like, well, he's behaving.
Right. He's playing his dissonant music, but he's not sort of, you know, hurting the kids.
As long as you do it in the house.
There's a huge passage in here about the geographic changes that occur.
Yeah.
It's wild. Like, I had no concept from as a beginning reader of, you know, in Lord of the Rings that, like, Tolkien's world is upended how many times? 2-3 times at least?
Many. Many, many.
Yeah.
And we're not done yet.
No, we're not. There's still more to come. Many lesser bays were made between the Great Gulf and Helcaraxi and the far. I mean, like, it goes on and on. Like, there's a whole passage about creating the stars, and there's all these other stuff. And then there's this whole passage about how the world is remade. It's wild.
Right. And Valinor gets sundered, right? Valinor mm-hmm. becomes way farther from Middle Earth than it was.
Yeah.
And so this is where it became really hard to get to Valinor without the help of the Valar. So one other point, many wars were fought, but because the elves were sheltered from it, they did not know anything about them.
Yeah.
Very interesting is that these again are histories written by the elves. These are supposed to be annals mm-hmm. of the elves. And so, of course, they can't tell you exactly what happened. And just think about how many wars happened here.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, many wars were fought. And this is the second round of that, because apparently many wars were fought before the elves even came in earlier, I think in the Valaquenta it was.
It's interesting. The definite, like, battle versus war, right?
Right.
So many wars. I mean, that's, you think of war as a bigger scale than a battle, right?
Right.
So many wars. I mean, the Valar and Melkor must have masses of resources at their collective disposal to be able to having these many wars.
Right. Well, and then, I mean, here's the question is, how long did the first age really last? Because, you know, we have the years, yeah. but those aren't really, there's a lot of debate as to when the years really start and to mm-hmm. also, like how did time work in the years of the trees? There's a lot of debate on that. Tolkien, if you read, like, the nature of Middle Earth and the history of Middle Earth, there's a lot of back and forth of one tree year might be 1,000 regular years, et cetera. It's a whole thing. And especially when you have the line later that Melkor was sent, I'll just say it now. Melkor was brought to the Ring of Doom and sued for pardon, but did not receive it. He was imprisoned for 3 long ages.
Right.
What? Right. Because we just learned that, you know, we're in the first stage, but then we have. So I think where we've mostly settled is the year of the years of the trees are sort of before the first age, but they're part of the first age in some ways you talk about it. It's hazy here.
Yeah, well, it's deep history. It's big history. It's well beyond the comprehension of mortal scale. Right.
Right.
Like, we just cannot conceive. We can't conceive of the life of the universe.
Right.
We can talk about billions of years and, you know, big bangs and all of these kinds of stuff. That's just intellectual, whatever, like that. We don't really have a real sense of how big or how long things have been going on from our little time slice perspective. So, yeah, this history of Melkor is, I think what, you know, at least I'm taking away, it was like, it's a massive time scale, far beyond the ability for me to, you know, to deal with. And so I just have to read it sort of in this poetic shortened form.
Right. And also, we don't have any beings that are not immortal yet. So I guess nobody mm-hmm. cares.
Fair enough.
Something I thought that was interesting, too, I'm going to backtrack a little bit to the actual capture of Melkor.
Yeah.
Is that very similarly to the creation of the trees, this is a collaborative effort to defeat Melkor
yes.
between several mm-hmm. of the Valar. So Tolkis wrestles with Melkor and Aule's chain binds him.
And casts him upon his face. I was like, that's a very strange thing to write. Like, Tolkis put his face in the dirt.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah. Tolkis is the jock, I'm telling you. He's
completely.
Just, yeah. He'll give you a swirly.
For big time. Wedgies and swirlies for everyone. And Aule's chain has a name.
It does. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that.
Anganor? Oh, boy. I'm not even going to do it. I'm sorry. Right. I apologize to all our Tolkien readers out of there. I tried, but I'm not going to try any harder.
Your apology is accepted. Thank you. Yeah, so Melkor is imprisoned. And yeah. We'll see how long that lasts.
And Sauron, they did not find.
Right. So he's going to still be wreaking havoc and causing mischief in Middle Earth.
Yeah, you know, when you said earlier about the Ring of Doom and his prayers were denied, this is a line that struck me. In the fastness of Mandos, whence none can escape, neither Vala nor elf nor mortal man. So Mandos's halls, his function is inescapable. If you're in within his realm, you know, whatever his control or whatever, that's it. That's where you are.
Right, right.
That now, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, he can let you go, but there's only one man that was ever done for, and we'll get to that. And then as far as elves, they can be reincarnated, but that's a whole other thing. And we can get to that as we go when we see elves who are perhaps reincarnated.
But this is just such a fascinating insight into Mandos's function and the mechanics of what Mandos does.
Right.
Right. You know, you may get sent to the halls of Mandos, fine, because you got died, you died in battle, you died of old age or whatever, so be it. But that is without, you know, you can't break what Mandos is,
right.
or what his, you know, neither Vala or elf nor mortal man, right? So
right.
Mandos is a force of nature in that regard.
Right. He'll tell you when you can go. He'll tell you when the men can go to the land beyond, and when the elves can get reincarnated, and when Melkor can be free of his chains. So the Great Journey. This is what we call the journey of the elves to Amon from Cui Vianan. And it was a rough time.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Valar saw the destruction of Middle-earth. They needed to decide what to do with the elves. While Ulmo and the others wanted the elves to be free to heal Middle-earth, Manwë and his council decided to invite the elves to live with them in the West.
Yeah.
What do you think about this debate? Ulmo, who is the water Vala, says, look, they're already in Cui Vianan, which is a watery place. Maybe Ulmo was like, I could visit them there. He's all for them going to forge their own way, right? To heal Middle Earth with their own powers. I think that's how they say it. And Manwë goes, no, let's just solve the problem ourselves. It's almost a teach a man to fish versus give him a fish, right?
Yeah, but then he's like, but we want the children here with us, and we want, you know, if these are Iluvatar's children, and they want to delight in them and delight in Iluvatar's creation, and they want them over here, I don't know, that's almost selfish in a way?
It is. I do think that this was a mistake, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, and here a line in this paragraph, from this summons came many woes that afterwards befell.
Right.
And so even right, it's just laid out right there, like this choice to call them caused a whole bunch of problems.
The case against Manwë.
It's growing stronger.
I need a court TV sound. Maybe I'll work on that.
Yeah, we need like the Law and Order sound. Ding, ding. Something that struck me with this line after this sort of debate thing here is that this statement, though, and again, I mean, I think it's well to take in the point that this is supposedly elvish a retelling, right? A point of view of the elves retelling history, but that many woes afterwards befell. Doesn't that assume that there's some sort of right answer that the Valar should have made, that they made the wrong choice? And I couldn't help but think, as a parent, one of the things that I've come to the understanding is no matter what I do, no matter how much I love my kid, and no matter how much I sort of create space for them to grow and to thrive and be healthy, I'm going to mess them up, right? Like there's going to be stuff that I do that's going to, you know, mess them up in some way.
Years
like
of just, therapy.
Years of therapy. Same like with my parents. You know, I wish no ill will on my child. My parents wish no ill will. But there's that fracturing, that separation, it is an inevitable thing where when child separates from parent, there's going to be these ruptures and you're going to do things that you didn't know that you did that impacted them in some way. So in a way, I don't think the Valar, Manway, and he has his ups and downs, as we like to, mess with him on. But I don't think that there's, I don't think what I'm trying to say is, no matter what the Valar chose, there would have been woes that afterwards befell.
I think that's right.
There's no right answer here.
Yeah, because Sauron's still in Middle Earth. So are the Balrogs and all these other servants of Melkor. It's not like it's a great place to live. It's certainly destroyed. I do think that there's an argument to be made that, Ulmo was right and they should have helped the elves settle Middle Earth and sort of branch out and heal the world a little bit more. Especially because the elves, many of them, as we're about to discover, did stay in Middle Earth and it was fine.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess if we're going to defend Manwë, which I almost refuse to do, he did give them a choice, right? He sent Orme to invite them, not to kidnap them.
Right. It wasn't ordered to that you will come. We're just requesting you come.
Right. And I don't think evil came out of that. I think evil comes out of something that happens later, which is, I think, when he says, don't go now.
Well, let's look at this sentence here again. From this summons came many woes, right? So it's not like many evils befell or bad, just through the course of life, you're going to experience woe, aren't you? Don't we?
Would you woe too?
Yeah, I mean, life is full of woe, isn't it? So no matter what you do.
What a note to move on with, David. I'm moving on now. Life is full of woe. Orme brought the summons to the elves. There are three kings of the elves, Ingwe, Finwë, and Elwë, and they are invited to see Valinor. They love the place.
Yeah. I just had to laugh at the three kings thing. Just very Christ story, right?
Yep. Also, I mean, just threes are great in Christianity, right? That's a big thing, the Holy Trinity, whatever. So they love the place, right? They go back to the elves and they say, hey, this is great. We should all go there. And so the elves begin their journey, but not all of them. Some were willing to make the journey, and those were called the Eldar, which, remember, before Orome named them all the Eldar, but the Eldar end up being just a subgroup of elves that at least attempt to go to Valinor.
This is where having those charts, these visual charts, is just really helpful.
Right. And so that's why when we talk about the full group of all elves, we're going to say Quendi, or just elves. That's fine. Mm-hmm. And then the subgroup that tried to go all the way west is the Eldar. Others, though, were more doubtful, and those were called the Avari, which means the unwilling.
Mm-hmm.
The division of the Eldar beyond this is based on how far they got on the trip. And something about the Avari, I'll say, is we basically never see them again. We don't know what happened to them after this, so you can just let that term go right out your brain.
And Tolkien never said anything about them?
Pretty much no, yeah.
Okay.
In fact, people were hoping that they were going to do the Avari in The Rings of Power, and then they just went with a Sylvan Elf instead.
Boy, that would be an interesting thing, somewhere to bring the Avari back in somehow. That would be pretty cool. I mean,
yeah.
If it were done badly, like, woe unto you. But if you did it good, that would be something amazing to see this like long lost group of elves reconnected and what that would entail. That would be a wild story.
Tell me a new story, don't just mess with what we already have.
Yeah.
So, who is ready to get on with the different groupings of elves? Bring out the flow charts, everyone.
Yes, exactly.
Again, go to the link in the description. You will find a flow chart, and it will be much easier for you to follow this. The first group I'm going to go through are the Vanyar, which means the Fair Elves. Their leader was Ingwe. They made it all the way to Aman, all the way to where the Valar are, and they stayed there. The Noldor are the Deep Elves. Their leader was Finwë. They made it all the way to Aman, again where the Valar are, but they eventually leave, which we'll discuss later. The Teleri is the biggest group. Those are the Sea Elves. They will later be subdivided into other groups. Their leader was Elwë, and then Olwë, his brother, will eventually lead them. These leaders, by the way, are not as important either. I mean, I would remember Finwë, I guess. Elwë will come into play under a different name next month. Some of the Teleri made it to Aman, and some of them did not. And we'll divide them, again, based on how far they went, who they live with, where they live, etc. Are we good so far, David?
Yeah, I'm with you. I got this chart here. It's that's the only thing that's keeping me oriented.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, the Vanyar don't come too far into the story. There's only some interaction with them because they're going to be in Aman the whole time. The Noldor are going to be the main characters of this story.
Right. Yeah.
The Teleri are involved, too. Some subdivisions of them, especially. But mostly the Noldor are going to be your heroes and villains of this story.
Got it.
Big distinction now between those who saw the light and didn't. We call those who saw the light the Caliquendi, and those who did not see the light as the Moriquendi, which again are subdivided into the Umanyar, who meant to see the light and did not, and the Avari, who were unwilling to see the light. All of those terms that I just said in this last part, the Caliquendi, the Moriquendi, the Umanyar, and the Avari, will never come up again.
Right. They're just not included in any story.
Right. I mean, just remember if they saw the light or not. You know what I mean? Just remember that the Noldor saw the light. Some of the Teleri did. We'll remind you as we go forward who saw the light and who didn't. And you won't have to remember Caliquendi or Moriquendi. So crossing the Anduin the Great and the Misty Mountains. The Teleri waited east of the mountains while the Vanyar and the Noldor crossed them. One of the Teleri led a group away, which became the Nandor. Later, another group crossed the mountains from the Nandor. The Vanyar and the Noldor crossed over the Blue Mountains and named the western part of Middle-earth Beleriand. Eventually, the Teleri were pushed by Elwë to join the other elves in Beleriand. All you need out of that is many of the elves went to a new place in the west, which is the westernmost part of Middle-earth called Beleriand. This is a place that does not exist in the Third Age, or the Second Age, really. And it's the main part of where our story is going to take place in the Silmarillion now.
Right. I have to say, when I said at the beginning that feeling of getting connected between this deep history and then the Lord of the Rings sort of history, it was really here, the crossing of the Anduin and the Great Misty Mountains. And it was suddenly like, oh, things were starting to click and connect in a particular way, and it was really here where I felt that larger world engagement, and that's when this whole chapter really altered, it altered for me, my perception of this whole chapter altered right in this moment of going, oh, here maybe it was because it's familiar landmarks or familiar sounding landmarks.
Well, now that we've gotten west of the Misty Mountains, we're not going back for another few thousand years.
More or less.
So anyway, that's pretty much the story, guys. Did you have fun?
Yeah, I said, it was it was engaging. It was very, very informationally rich.
Very cool. So if this felt like a textbook reading to you, as it may have, take heart, because next month we are reading of Thingol and Melian, which is much more of sort of a fairy tale. It's sort of a fable almost. It's a lot lighter reading. It's a lot more fun. And we have a guest, so you won't just hear us rambling about it for 2 hours. I think it's time we go to feedback, David.
Sounds like a good plan. If you want to send us feedback, we really would love to have your feedback. You can send it to lotr@thelorehounds.com. Or you can head over to thelorehounds.com to our website. And there on the contact page, there's a form. You can fill that out, or you can leave us a voicemail. Or you could even jump on our Discord and leave us a message there or get into conversation, and we can rope that into our feedback sections as well.
Very cool.
So first up, we have some feedback from Marilyn R. Pukila, our favorite Tolkien scholar, and we're excited to have her in involved in our Earthsea project.
We're also excited to have her on in August 2024 for Of Turin Turambar, which she has claimed over a year in advance.
She has totally claimed that one. So sorry, folks, if you wanted to jump in on that one, you got to talk to Marilyn about it. All right. Marilyn says, I was amused that my pronunciation was a topic of conversation for one listener. Let me say that it was only 3 years ago that I began to struggle to learn how to tap, roll, and or trill my R's through a series of group Finnish lessons on Zoom. Okay, so this is reference to a feedback that we had last episode where somebody wrote in to make mention of how to pronounce words, you know, how Tolkien's guide for pronunciation and stuff, and they referenced Marilyn and her ability to do these cool R rolling. So she says, she continues, virtually all Finnish R's are rolled, and learning Finnish was one of my retirement goals. So the in-Zoom lessons from two different teachers layered with Duolingo helped me, and we're not sponsored by them, by the way, helped me achieve it, though it took a few years and I'm still working at it. Having it apply to Tolkien as well is an added bonus, and I will confess to some pride at being able to do it now, but I do apologize to all listeners who find it distracting or worse.
I love when she rolls her R's. I mean, it makes me feel like I don't know how to say words, but it's great to hear. I mean, that's clearly how it's supposed to sound. So thank you, Marilyn.
Yeah, it's interesting because Tolkien was such a lover of language, and we do so... gloss over is not the right word, but we just sort of blow past a lot of that detail around pronunciation and the way that language sounds. And we're very modern in our ways around that. So hearing an approximation of what Tolkien would have wanted it to sound like is pretty cool. Yeah, definitely.
Funny, though, that Tolkien was an indistinct speaker, reportedly. So it was kind of hard to understand him when he was in a mood of explaining things.
Okay.
Kind of funny that he was such a linguist and then he would be like, blah, 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 blah.
Interesting. So friend of the pod and Lorehound Patreon, E. Hoop, writes in and says, might I suggest when the schedule is updated that the Darkening of Valinor and the Flight of the Noldor be crammed into a single month? Christopher Tolkien reads those two chapters together, and it's easily available on YouTube. He does the best reading you'll find of the Silmarillion, full stop. It's tragic that he didn't do the whole book, but he does also do Beren and Luthien. He's got more to say, but first, let's think about that. What do you think, John?
I already did that, so I took your suggestion, E-Hoop, when I was...
There you go.
Because I finally did the rest of the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to put the whole thing in the show notes just in case things change, but also because I don't want a 7-page show note. But yeah, no, I followed your suggestion, E-Hoop, after looking into it. We are going to do those two chapters together, so thank you.
Nice. And did you check out the YouTube with Christopher Tolkien?
I did not yet, but I definitely will.
Okay. Should we throw that into our show notes?
Sure.
Okay. We'll find that and we'll throw a link in at the bottom. All right, E. Hoop continues. Also, while I wouldn't presume to even hint that you get more aggressive with the schedule so we can hit Ak-Alabeth before Ring of Power Season 2, I'd recommend to anyone that after Silmarillion...
Kirion and Aeorl.
Thank you, from Unfinished Tales, and Appendix A from Return of the King are super beautiful reads and really... flesh out the historical events, e.g. the founding of Rohan and the Goblin Wars, of which Bilbo's older companions were veterans, and which tells us a lot about both the dwarves and the goblins in the Hobbit.
Cool. Yeah, so about making it the schedule more aggressive, we cannot right now. We're just too busy with other shows right now. But note taken. I mean, I wish we could go through this faster. But also at the same time, I'm kind of enjoying doing a really slow burn with the Silmarillion, yeah, which I normally don't do because I'm so eager to like move on and see where the story goes. But I don't know. It's kind of nice to just take a back seat for a minute.
Leisurely pace. You know, and it has the upside too that people who are reading along, I mean, we're all busy in life these days. And so it's nice that we're not pushing a hard schedule because it can be difficult for people to keep up reading. So.
And it only takes you 2.5 years to finish the Silmarillion.
We're really stretching it out. All right. From the Discord, Severin says that they're rewatching the Lord of the Rings trilogy and had a quick question. Why are the Nazgul afraid of water?
Yeah, so there's a passage, I think it's in the Ain Lindale. I answered this on the Discord too. If you want real-time feedback, head on to our Discord, link in the show notes. But anyway, in the Ain Lindale, there's a passage where basically the music of the Ainur is still within the waters because, you know, Ulmo is going in and out of the waters and water is for some reason more difficult to corrupt for Melkor. Uh-huh. And then also Tolkien, you know, he's a fan of folklore and evil beings having trouble crossing running water is a thing. So, yeah, there's sort of an in-world and an out-of-world explanation. Like, he liked the folklore thing, but also the water seems to be more pure, less easily corruptible by Melkor, and Ulmo is in and out of the waters, which is pretty cool.
Okay. So that's it for feedback for this podcast. Again, write into us, lotr@thelorehounds.com, or jump over to our website and use the contact form or voicemail feature there. We would love to get your feedback. Part of the joy of doing the podcasting is the sort of asymmetric interaction that we get with you guys. So definitely send us in your questions, your thoughts, things that you're interested in, passages, if there's a sentence that you would like us to read on air, and you can sort of give us a maybe why that, you know, that particular sentence or paragraph really struck you. Yeah, we want to solicit as much of your feedback as possible. So send it in.
Well, David, I think we need to do our Patreon shout-outs now.
We do.
We have 3 tiers for our patrons, and special thanks to all of our Patreon subscribers. But our top subscribers pay $10 a month, which, again, we still act in disbelief, and yet this army keeps growing. We can't even keep up with it. We have Samartian, Cyrus, Mark H., Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., Nick W., SC, Peter O., Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Lavinia T. Wow. Yeah. Wow, wow. I mean, I need a glass of water after that list.
This is, we're at 14 lore masters so far. And this, at the time of the recording, you know, who knows what will happen by the end of the month when this is released. So really, thank you all so very much for being part of this community and for contributing to John and I being able to do this. We're having a lot of fun, and we're really grateful that you guys want to express your gratitude to us by being supporters. So thank you.
Absolutely. And I'll say our Patreon has been a lot more conversational lately, and I appreciate that.
It's been great.
I feel like we've been just chatting with you guys with the comments. So thanks. Keep sending them in. I'm having fun with it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. All right, John, let's talk a little bit about programming notes. It's a little bit hard because we're recording earlier in the month, and this is going to come out later in the month. But what we've got going on right now is we should have wrapped up by now on The Last of Us on HBO. So far, it's been a great season. Our season wrap-up podcast should drop on the 21st of March. And it's been awesome. So, like, we're really glad we covered that. You and our friend Brandon the Bard have a new project. You want to talk quickly about Lorehound's Play, because it actually dovetails into the wrap up of The Last of Us.
Yeah, actually, we're doing a coverage of the game The Last of Us Part 1, which is what season 1 of the show is based on. And we meant to do 1.5 to 2 hour podcast, and we got through half the game in 2 hours. So we had to stop recording that night, because we were all very sleepy at that point. And we're going to do a two-parter. We're going to do a two-podcast review of this game, because it's just so dense and so rich.
And what are you doing? Are you kind of doing it like we do with a television show, where you're sort of breaking different pieces down and giving reactions? Or tell us a little bit more about how the podcast is going to structure.
Yeah, so we basically give a high-level overview of the plot, and in sections. And then in each section, we talk about different sequences that were interesting, the gameplay, the character moments, etc. So yeah, and we talk about the production details. So it is very similar to how we cover a show, but we're just covering a game. And the goal with the Lorehounds Play is not to just talk about video games as video games, but it's to talk about these video games with rich stories.
Got
and
it.
With rich character moments, and that really leave an impact on you and make you think. So this month we're doing The Last of Us Part 1. Next month we're going to be doing Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order to tie in with The Mandalorian. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun too.
And speaking of The Mandalorian, we have just started Mandalorian Season 3, so that'll be in full swing by the time this podcast drops. And so we'll be covering that weekly. So look for those podcasts on Thursday, I think is roughly when we're trying to get those out. We also will be wrapping up Bad Batch. And I really want to talk about Visions as well when we get to our wrap up of the Bad Batch season 2.
Nice.
So far, Bad Batch season 2 has been really interesting. They've really gone some places with the plots. And the Bad Batch, they're like really all over the universe and getting into involved in a lot of stuff. So there's going to be a lot to talk about there for the back half of that season. And then if you don't know about Visions, Visions is a really interesting project where Disney has licensed the Star Wars concept out to a whole bunch of different animation studios all around the world. And so these are these really wild alternate takes on what the Star Wars universe is perceived by these different animation houses. And there's these little stories and vignettes. Some of them are quite big in scope. Some are quite focused. Some of them are really good. Some of them are not so good. But Vision Season 2 is about to drop. And I think if you're into the Star Wars world, or if you're just into animation and anime, then Visions is a really interesting exploration of the Star Wars IP in this different way. So I really want to talk about that.
Yeah.
If I am not clear that I want to talk about it.
It's kind of cool when they free you from the constraints of canon. You can just do what you want.
It's amazing. Yeah.
I mean, I'm reading the Darth Bane novels right now, which is another Legends non-canon story. And I'm just like, this is so fun to just sort of let go of the constraints of I need everything to be internally consistent.
Skywalker, Vader, Force, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Very cool. Ted Lasso is also in full swing by the time this comes out. Season 3, final season. We will be covering it. We're not quite sure exactly our format for it, but stay tuned for our takes on this, because I think it's going to be a really juicy season. I'm really looking forward to this.
Me too.
And I think we'll have some fun covering the show.
Yeah.
Jean and I finally got around to reconnecting and recording our podcast for our next MC universe. And that's where we talk about Quantumania and the Ant-Man, not as a movie review, but sort of a meta context and looking at Kang and what Kang's going to be bringing to Phase 5. We get into talking about some of the characters that we're going to see emerging in Phase 5. And we talk about some of the meta context, the deeper themes that we're starting to see emerge in this next phase of storytelling. So that was a lot of fun.
I'm looking forward to editing it tomorrow.
Yay.
Second Breakfast should be out already for our patrons. That's where we discuss a bunch of things that we're reading and playing and watching. And we're talking about coffee this month, and I'm excited. I used to be a barista, and I have some fun stories. I made a note for you that I want to talk about the story of Pirate Tom
Tom.
And I have not given you any context, so I'm hoping that it lands.
None whatsoever. Yeah.
We're having a lot of fun. Cool. Earthsea, we're covering it with Marilyn R. Pukila, our favorite Tolkien scholar, on the Book Nook. That'll be on this feed as well. Silmarillion Stories, you've just heard the March version. And next month, we are doing Of Thingol and Melian with Mary Clay from That's What I'm Talking About. Great chapter. It's going to be really fun. Silmarillion Stories in June, we'll have a guest, Maester Anthony of Feanor and the Unchaining of Melkor. We were on Electric Bookaloo on the Bald Move Hot D feed, so check that out if you missed us. And we'll be on Bookaloo again in April, on April 13th, I think, covering another chapter from a Clash of Kings.
Ooh, John, March Madness for the Lorehounds.
I don't know what we're doing, man. This just happened.
It's crazy. Yeah, well, there's just shows that we couldn't say no to. Ted Lasso, Mando, and then we've got all of these other cool side projects that we're doing And I think one of the fun things that we're doing too is that we're bringing in some different voices.
Agreed.
And teaming up with some different people to cover some fun stuff. So Marilyn, Jean, Brandon. It's wild. And it's all thanks to you guys.
The Lorehound's empire grows.
Well, on that note, check out our Patreon if you want to support us. Otherwise, you know, feel free to enjoy the ad-supported podcasts. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. As always, rate, like, and review. If you want to chat with us and other like-minded members of the Lorehounds community, hit us up in the Discord, link in the show notes below.
And don't forget to read of Thingol and Melian so that you can hear us with our guest, Mary Clay, of That's What I'm Talking About next month.
Thanks, everyone.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced by the Lorehounds and published by Bald Move. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening. Hey, listeners, if you've been listening to our show, chances are you've heard the wonderful contributions of our favorite Tolkien scholar, Marilyn R. Pukila. Marilyn just launched her own podcast on our network called Rings and Rituals.
Join me and Dr. Sara Brown on our journey through the Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power, through the lens of ritual. Episodes drop every other Wednesday on the Rings and Rituals feed, linked in the show notes. See you there.